From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Big Spring is a town of about 30,000 people at the edge of oil country in West Texas. It's the place down-on-his-luck dishwasher Joe Buck flees at the beginning of the 1969 cult classic, Midnight Cowboy.
What are you gonna do back east?
Hell, what do I got to stay around here for?
Back then, the town's economic engine was the Webb Air Force Base. But after the Vietnam War, the base shut down. Johnny Lou Avery Boyd was president of the local Chamber of Commerce at the time. And she says people thought the town was about to disappear.
That's what scared them to death. They said, you know, I own this little roofing company and we're going to have all these vacant houses in town. There's not going to be anybody to repair these houses because there's nobody to sell them to. There's just that enormous pessimism that sets in when something really major bad is happening.
But Johnny Lou is no pessimist. She made calls and lobbied politicians to lure a new industry that took over the offices and dormitories in the heart of the old base. That industry was prisons. Two low-security federal prisons with one big difference. The first one was run by the government, and Johnny Lou describes it as the town's best friend. Inmates would come to church and decorate street lamps downtown at Christmas time, but the second federal prison?
I don't think it was the same feel at all. I don't think it ever has been, but it has not been something that is like a hated relative. It's more like, well, that's a distant relative.
That distant relative holds people convicted of federal crimes, but only ones who are not U.S. citizens. And it's run by a private company, not the U.S. government. It's one of 11 private prisons for non-citizens that the Federal Bureau of Prisons contracted starting in 2000 in the hopes of cutting costs. But recently, journalists and advocates have raised questions about how that cost cutting has affected the inmates after a series of riots.
This is new at 10. An FBI affidavit details what happened during an almost eight-hour deadly riot.
Housing units set on fire. Inmates violently shaking the fence.
The inmate told us they want the public to know the reason they're doing this is because an inmate was sick and they don't believe he was given the proper medical care.
Inmates actually did so much damage to one prison, it had to be shut down. And they did it in part over complaints of medical negligence. But it's been nearly impossible to figure out what kind of medical care inmates are getting until now. Seth Fried Wessler, a reporter for the Investigative Fund, won a lawsuit to get an extensive set of medical files from these prisons. Then he spent a year tracking down the stories they contained, from Mexico to Mississippi to Big Spring, Texas. That's where Reveal's Dan Alcorn joins him on the story.
If you want to know what's going on inside a prison, you can't just walk in the front door and look around. But in the case of Big Spring's private federal prison, you can get a pretty good look at the soccer field. From the road, through a couple barbed wire fences, you can see men in khaki and white streaming out of a squat tan building, playing soccer, walking in pairs around the track. A short guy by the soccer goal is playing an accordion.
I've been looking into what happens in these prisons for years. This is the closest I've gotten to getting inside.
From here, Seth and I can see clues about what makes this prison different from the government-run prison next door. The inmates are mostly speaking Spanish. Again, they're all non-citizens. The sign out front says Geo Group, Inc. That's the private company hired by the Federal Bureau of Prisons to run the place. But inside the prison, especially when it comes to medical care, the big difference is in the rules they have to follow.
Generally speaking, when prison experts talk about the Bureau of Prisons, they say that it's the best functioning prison system in the United States. But the kinds of rigorous policies that the Bureau of Prisons has developed to regulate staffing patterns and what kinds of workers do what in the provision of medical care, those rules aren't applied to the BOP's private prisons.
Seth wanted to find out how that affects patients, so he filed a public record request that got him over 9,000 pages of medical files and internal investigations, covering the entire 15-year history of these private prisons for non-citizens.
With handwritten notes from nurses and doctors, they're literally detailing minute by minute what's happening inside of medical clinics inside of these prisons.
Seth had doctors read all these files, and they found a pattern. Cases where lower standards and less qualified, less expensive workers came together to produce a medical disaster. Seth and I came to Big Spring to tell the story of one of those cases. But to understand what happened, it helps to start before things went wrong, when the guy in charge of healthcare was Dr. John Farquhar. Between 2010 and 2014, he was the one doctor for the more than 3,000 inmates.
Well, technically, I worked a 40-hour week, but you can't practice medicine on a 40-hour week. That's me.
Dr. Farquhar has rigid posture and a military haircut.
Hello.
And at 85 years old, he's still practicing medicine full-time, 7 days a week if he needs to.
I've always had a seven-day approach to medicine, and I didn't see anything unusual about that.
But he was unusual when compared to the other doctors in the prison medical files.
He was writing more notes than just about any other doctor in any of the other prisons. He was there all the time.
Whereas in other private prisons for non-citizens, medical notes were being written and medical decisions were being made by low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses with only a year of training.
And then I started reading what he was writing.
Some of Dr. Farquhar's notes start normally by describing someone's symptoms or vital signs, but then they just go off, railing against his bosses, especially when they blocked him from transferring inmates out who were too sick to take care of in his limited prison clinic.
In one case, he wrote, "This man will almost certainly die," and that the Bureau of Prisons would, he wrote, "rush to find someone to blame, blithely ignoring the casual and repeated ways he has been dumped onto Big Spring."
There are times when I was critical. I'm a critical person, starting with myself.
You actually wrote at one point, "I feel bad for his shabby care."
Well, I stand by that statement. I don't know who it's about, and I can't comment on any single record of any person. But there are times when the care was not what I wanted for any patient, period.
He told us there was constant pressure to keep costs down. For instance, early on, his higher-ups told him to look at the number of times the prison had paid for an ambulance to take an inmate to the hospital.
They said, "You know, is there a way that we can cut this down?" And I said, "Probably yes."
I could imagine that could result in a pressure to not call when somebody really needs to go to the emergency room.
That's always the risk. That's why professional judgment takes professional training and professional experience, because you can't leave it up to anybody.
When Dr. Farquhar was clinical director, he was the one making those decisions. He was effectively always on call, and doctors who reviewed the medical files said he seemed to be doing as good a job as he could. But after 4 years, he said he was very tired, and he quit.
And then not long after he left the prison, there's a case that exhibits all of the problems that he was worried about.
The case of Nestor Garay. Back in 1998, when he was 25, Nestor came from Mexico City to wine country, Napa Valley, California.
It's beautiful here.
Where he moved in with his parents, Alvara and Indy.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Seth and I visited them at their house, just a couple blocks from the natural food stores and bike shops of Main Street, St. Helena. When Nestor first moved here, he was like peas in a pod with his younger brother, Enrique.
They say when we answer the phone, we sound the same and we smile kind of the same.
They worked out at the gym together, and they worked together at the Sunshine Food Market. Nestor was in the cheese section. Enrique cut meat. But while Enrique went on to get a better job, buy his own house, and become a U.S. citizen, Nestor just stayed in the same bedroom in his parents' house.
He was very strongly attached to my mom and dad. Yeah, to be with them is like a pet. He wanted to be with them the whole time. But in a good way, because Nestor was a good son and all that, regardless of his addiction.
His addiction. It started with alcohol, but turned to meth. He started dealing to support his habit, sold to an undercover cop, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And because he'd never become a U.S. citizen, at 41, he ended up in the private GEO Group prison for non-citizens in Big Spring. His parents have stacks of letters Nestor sent them from prison, each of them with a hand-drawn and colored cartoon on the envelope. There's a jack-o'-lantern for Halloween, an orange cat with a bow on its head opening a gift for Christmas. His dad, Indy, opens one.
Nada más para saludarlos y decirles que todo está bien aquí en Texas.
The letter starts, "Just to say hello and tell you all is well in Texas." And then, early one Thursday morning, Indy told us they got a phone call. It was Nestor's cellmates calling from inside the prison in Big Spring with bad news. Seth tracked down three of these cellmates, including Irineo Espinosa. Speaking by phone from Mexico, Irineo says it all started when he and the other men in the cell were asleep. At 1 a.m, Nestor starts moaning. Irineo says Nestor is trying to speak, but he can only make signs with his hands. Irineo and the other cellmates carry him to a lower bunk and realize he's wet himself. They open the door and tell the guard outside that Nestor needs medical attention. Irineo says about a half hour later, a nurse arrives. It's licensed vocational nurse Gary Austin, the only medical professional at the prison that night. And it's his note that begins the medical file. It says, quote, upon arriving to inmate room, inmate lying on bottom bunk, looking straight ahead, but not responding to name. He writes that Nestor's sweaty. He has a weak grip on one side, and the cellmates think he's had a seizure. The cellmates are told to carry Nestor downstairs to the building's bare bones clinic. And there, instead of calling 911, Gary phones the physician assistant who's on call that night, Russell Amaru. Russell's at home asleep, but he wakes up and over the phone makes two key decisions. First, he tells the nurse to give Nestor Dilantin, an anti-seizure medication. And then, when Nestor can't swallow the pills, the notes show he gives a new order. Quote, send back to unit and place on mattress on floor. So the cellmates are asked to carry Nestor back upstairs. But Irineo says,
no.
The cellmates said no.
No. Él necesita atención médica profesional.
He says he needs professional medical attention. Ask for a helicopter, an ambulance, that can take him to a clinic so he can get the care he needs. Ultimately, Nestor isn't returned to their cell. So the cellmates go to sleep thinking Nestor was taken to a hospital.
Y al día siguiente nos damos cuenta que qué fue lo que pasó.
Irineo says the next day they find out what happened.
Que lo llevaron a otra celda.
Nestor was just brought to another cell nearby and was left on a mattress on the floor until the morning shift arrived. By now, 5 hours have passed since Nestor started moaning, and he's transformed. He can't move his right side. His attempts to speak have become smacking sounds. The morning shift nurse, a more highly trained registered nurse, calls the prison's clinical director, a doctor, and they send Nestor to the nearest ER, where a CAT scan shows a massive stroke. He's then helicoptered to the Midland Memorial Hospital. We wanted to find out what happened to him there, so Seth and I went to the hospital and tracked down the neurologist who treated him that day.
Hi, doctor.
Hey.
How are you?
How are you?
Good.
Dr. John Foster.
If someone comes in having just had a massive ischemic stroke, how soon would they need to come in here for you to be able to do anything for them?
Well, to be anything aggressive to them within 3 hours.
So as each hour passes...
Each minute, you have thousands of brain cells dying.
And if someone does come in 5 hours later, what can you do at that point?
For us, man, nothing.
Nestor's parents say the prison finally called them that afternoon, but they didn't tell them that Nestor had had a stroke, much less the details they'd heard hours earlier from the cellmates. So the next day, as they were preparing to fly to Texas, Nestor's dad, Indy, called the prison to get more information.
What was the captain's name?
His granddaughter recorded some of the call.
Do you know how long you're going to be here?
I don't know, not sure. It depends. You know, how is Nestor?
I haven't heard nothing today.
In the hospital, Nestor was shackled to the bed, and two prison guards were keeping watch when his family arrived. His dad, Indy, his brother, Enrique, and his mom, Alvara.
When we got there, I restrained myself. I didn't want to scream. I didn't want to yell because I really felt that my son could hear me. I didn't want him to hear me upset.
As soon as my mom started talking to Nestor, my mom hugged Nestor and Nestor cried. That's something I'm never going to forget. Somehow he was still there.
But the doctors told them that tear was just a reflex. Nestor was already gone. He was brain dead. His body was just being kept alive by the life support.
Fíjense qué crueldad.
I mean, look at the cruelty here. It wasn't until after they took him off life support that they took the shackles off.
Como que dijeron, si todavía vives.
It was as if they were saying, if you're still alive, then you're under my control.
The prison did its own internal review of what happened to Nestor Garay, and we got a copy. It found diagnosis was delayed, treatment was inappropriate, documentation was unacceptably incomplete. When Nestor didn't get better, the nurse or the physician assistant should have contacted the prison's doctor or top nurse. In other words, many things went wrong. But according to the four physicians we had independently review the medical file, the right thing to do was simple.
Call 911 is what he should have done.
That's neurologist Carolyn Martin.
If he had gotten there right away, he would have had a chance of survival. Not getting there right away, his chance of survival was really terrible. The prisoner was right, they should have called 911.
One reason they didn't call 911 could be the level of training of the only medical professional at the prison that night, Gary Austin. He's only a licensed vocational nurse, or LVN.
LVNs are essentially supervised, so they are not working independently.
Roberta Lavin is a nursing professor who used to work at a government-run federal prison. She says LVNs are usually supervised by a more highly trained registered nurse. While that higher-level nurse would know how to help someone with a gunshot wound, say, an LVN would help after they'd been stitched up, when it's time to give out the next dose of painkillers.
Or it's time to change that bandage.
She says to put LVNs alone on overnights at prisons, responding to emergencies, may save money, but it endangers inmates.
Having a person who has a more narrow scope of practice and is less prepared to deal with emergencies, what you're doing is you're putting barriers between that person who may have a medical emergency and the care.
You don't see this barrier to care in the government-run federal prisons. They have rules that specify what LVNs can do. But those rules don't apply to these private prisons. In a statement, GeoGroup said they strive to meet all the same standards, practices, and policies of government-run federal prisons. But after interviewing corrections officials and reviewing thousands of pages of medical files, Seth found something different.
We see over and over again, low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses, are providing the bulk of medical care. Doctors who reviewed the files raised questions about whether those licensed vocational nurses were operating beyond the kind of care that they're trained to provide.
Seth got the medical files of 103 men who all died in these private federal prisons for non-citizens. And doctors who reviewed those files and additional evidence said 25 of those men likely died as a result of inadequate medical care that they got in prison.
One of these cases, a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, was seen repeatedly, over and over again, complaining of headaches and back pain and nausea, and was only ever treated with ibuprofen and Tylenol and sent back to his bed. And he's nearly only seen by LVNs.
In fact, there's no record of him ever being sent to the prison doctor. After nearly 2 years of this, he's finally sent out to a hospital, where within days he dies of an AIDS-related brain infection. Doctors who reviewed the files said he should have been diagnosed with HIV long before. That case happened at another private prison for non-citizens, about 2 hours west of Big Spring, called Reeves. Last year, that prison was investigated by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, a watchdog for the Bureau of Prisons. And we described Claudio's medical treatment and death to the Inspector General himself, Michael Horowitz.
It certainly doesn't surprise me what you're saying.
His review didn't look at the use of LVNs, but it did look at the number of total medical staff. And it found that in 34 out of 37 months, the prison had failed to meet the minimum required by its contract.
I think it raises two concerns. How does it impact individual inmates, and what does it mean for their health and safety? And the second is, why was it happening for 34 out of 37 months? Why wasn't that caught before we showed up?
He's asking not just why this company was breaking the rules, but why the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is supposed to enforce the rules, failed to notice any problems for 3 years straight. Since Nestor's death, his parents have kept his bedroom in their Napa Valley home the way he left it.
Bueno, en este cuarto les voy a ser honesta.
I'll be honest with you. We sleep in this room.
They sleep surrounded by Nestor's things.
Esta es su ropa de mi hijo.
His mom, Alvara, shows us Nestor's pants in the dresser, his hat on the door.
Me da tristeza por esto.
She picks up a pair of his gym shorts from the closet,
pero,
and smells them before she puts them back.
His clothes, I think we should get rid of it, give it someone who needs it. But you want to keep him too?
That's Nestor's older brother, Carlos. And he wants to help his family move on. But he also wants to know why his brother wasn't taken to the hospital sooner.
I can make a list of people that were involved, but who's really responsible? Who's the boss? So I want an answer from the person who contracts these companies, and I want an answer from the warden.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons, which contracted GEO Group to run the prison, wouldn't agree to an interview and didn't respond to written questions. The GEO Group and its medical subcontractor, Correct Care Solutions, said because of privacy concerns, they were unable to comment on individual medical files. Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse who was at the prison that night, didn't return our messages. But Russell Amaru, the physician assistant who the medical file says gave the order over the phone to send Nestor back to his cell instead of a hospital...
Hi.
Are you Mr. Amaru?
I could be, and who are you?
Seth and I visited his house in a condo complex 40 minutes outside Big Spring, Texas.
Let me ask you guys a question. How'd you find out about me?
At first, he refused to speak with us.
You're not supposed to talk. That's one of the problems with the prison system.
But eventually, he led us into his kitchen and spoke for several hours because he wanted the world to know about all the other factors that he said prevented the medical staff at Big Spring from doing their jobs as well as they should.
There would have been a more aggressive care for that patient and other patients, too, if we had better training, better staff. It's just so many things are wrong there.
He explains the decisions he made the night Nestor died, decisions doctors and the prison's own review said were wrong by pointing to a failure of communication. He says all the information he had was what he was told over the phone by Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse at the prison. Gary wrote in the file that Nestor was unresponsive and had a weak grip. But Russell says he was told something different.
He was up and communicating. It just, he was not real lucid.
And he pins that miscommunication on Gary's lack of training, the fact that he was an LVN, also called an LPN.
You had an LPN right out of school, new in corrections, trying to make an assessment. He did not have the skills. I don't blame them as the person. I blame the management system that puts him in that position.
It's easy to blame the person. And the four physicians who reviewed Nestor's file and the prison's own review did find fault with both Gary, the LVN, and Russell, the physician assistant. But if you blame only the person, you let the system that put them in that position off the hook. And the system that Russell describes is one that puts its staff and its inmates in a position that's always just one mistake away from a catastrophe.
Basically, what you have in essence is people that are undertrained doing jobs that they shouldn't be doing. We do not have an infirmary for 24-hour observation. Charts are often temporarily lost for a couple of days or a week or so. And so the companies that I work for, all the way up to BOP, they've got the model of how the place is supposed to be run, and they seem to allow it. And I know you want to ask me, what would I do to correct the problem? I'd close this whole facility down, and I'd start over again.
The Department of Justice's Inspector General is currently reviewing all of the contracts for private federal prison for non-citizens, but it can only make suggestions to the decision makers at the Bureau of Prisons. Those decision makers can pull the plug on the Big Spring and Reeves prisons because both of those contracts are up for renewal in 2017. The decision about whether or not to extend them is expected later this year. You can read the investigative fund reporter Seth Fried Wessler's full investigation in The Nation magazine. But after the break, we'll turn to the question of where these prisons came from in the first place. It's a story of a major shift in criminal justice policy, and also a story of a father risking everything for his sons. That's coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.